A common theme of capitalism over the past few weeks has been whether shareholders have too much power. That is, whether corporations end up maximizing shareholder value at the expense of employees, consumers, creditors, and members of the community.
One way to address the issue is transferring power away from shareholders to manager, and doesn't necessarily empower the other groups. It could end up giving CEOs full reign over corporate landscape without any checks and balances.
One of the things I'm always afraid of is that there are rules changing in the background, rules that might have a serious impact on how markets work, but they don't get much attention from the public.
We may be living through one of those moments now. While there is attention being paid in the media to voter suppression in presidential and congressional elections, and rightfully so, there is less attention being paid to voter suppression in corporate elections. And the Securities and Exchange Commission, the agency in charge of regulating American corporations, is in the process of changing some of the key rules in corporate voting. And I claim that some of these changes might have more impact than changing in at least the gubernatorial election. The power of Facebook is probably bigger than the power of the state of Arizona. Sorry for people from Arizona.
On today's episode, we're going to explain how shareholder voting works and discuss whether the new SEC rules could have unintended consequences. From Georgetown University, I'm Kate Waldock.
And from the University of Chicago, I'm Luigi Zingales.
You're listening to Capitalism, a podcast about what's working in capitalism today.
And most importantly, what isn't. Now, who better to discuss the new SEC rules than an SEC commissioner?
Today, we are incredibly lucky to be joined by Commissioner Rob Jackson, who is also a professor of law at NYU Law. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so let's get to shareholder voting. The first thing to be clear about is that CEOs in the United States, they have a lot of power. But there are a couple checks on this power, and one of those checks is through the board of directors, and the other check is through this annual meeting that every public company in the United States has to have, where shareholders can vote on various proposals, some of which are put forward by management and some of which are put forward by the shareholders themselves. You don't have to attend the annual meeting to actually vote because often it's like in expensive places and you have to pay for your plane tickets and stuff. So rather than attending the meeting, you can just mail in your vote and vote by what's called proxy. This used to be done by snail mail, but now it's for the most part electronic. So on today's episode, we're going to focus on shareholder voting. To talk about this, we should go back to a time, say the 70s, when managers definitely had way too much control. But Rob and I probably don't remember the 70s very well. I think, Luigi, you're our best bet. So can you tell us about the corporate landscape in the 70s?
Okay, let's be clear here. I was a little kid in the 70s, okay? Let's not exaggerate how old I was. But because I was interested in corporate governance since early age, very early age, I can tell you some experience. I think that the so-called shareholder revolution started in the early 80s. In the 1970s, boards were still incredibly large, for mostly by insiders, and the CEO was extremely powerful. The only attempt to break into the corporate arena was done by political activists that were fighting to stop the Vietnam War. And so you had some proposal to vote at shareholders' meeting regarding banning the production of Agent Orange or stopping supply ammunition for the Vietnam War or stuff like that. Some of the SEC rules come from a period where shareholders' proposals are seen as just a way to break in the peace and harmony and efficiency of the corporate arena for political purposes that have nothing to do with the company itself.
Well, certainly in the 1970s, that was a very consistent theme of concerns that were raised and the SEC rules that were designed to address these considerations. But then in the 1980s, we had the emergence of the takeover wave and a number of disciplining forces entering the marketplace to try to check the power of CEOs, which was being used at that time to build large corporate empires or for perquisites or salaries, that it didn't make sense from investors' point of view. But activist investors in the 90s and the early 2000s, and even over the last decade, have been arriving on the corporate scene, demanding change from CEOs and corporate boards, and in many cases getting it. So there has been some success in checking CEOs through the activist investing and shareholder proposal process.
But most of this effective intervention takes the form of replacing people on the board or replacing even entire board by an active investor. When it comes to proposals to direct corporate policy made by shareholders, most of them don't receive the endorsement of management, and most of them don't get approved. In fact, in the last proxy season, the one of 2019, only 14 proposals made by shareholders won support. One was actually a proposal by a Catholic-affiliated investment service asking Walgreens to compile a report on the reputational risk stemming from the opioid sales. The other was a proposal by a social investing fund asking travelers to produce a report on its workforce diversity. But things are on the verge of a change. For example, a proposal to force disclosure of lobbying by Walt Disney, made by some investors, reached 39% of Disney shareholders, which of course is not a majority, but is pretty close to a majority. And so I think that the world is changing, or at least is about to change.
So that's right. One question you might ask if you're an ordinary shareholder is, hey, who decides what actually gets voted on in a shareholder meeting? And the answer is that the standard corporate governance proposals are often brought by significant funds, public policy groups, religious orders, institutional investors who want to bring forward corporate governance reforms. Now, as I noted in a statement that I issued last week when the SEC changed our rules, it's also well known that a few individuals actually dominate these annual shareholder meetings. They're sometimes derisively referred to as shareholder gadflies. In fact, some statistics would say those individuals bring as much as a majority or even more of the proposals at any given shareholder meeting.
Luigi, is there not a story about a gadfly that you might know off the top of your head?
Oh, there are a lot of stories about gadflies. In fact, I thought this crazy stuff happened only in Italy, where I saw some of these guys in action. No, they happen also in the United States. The most famous one is actually a woman, Evelyn Davis, that started to make proposals since the late 50s. Basically, she made a good living by selling a publication that was not particularly valuable, but every corporation was subscribing to for the price of $600. Why? Because that was a way to mollify her, make sure that she wasn't raising a controversial issue at the shareholders meeting. So with 1,000 subscriptions of 1,000 corporations, she was making $600,000 a year. That was not a bad salary, especially back then, just to make proposal as a threat point and cash in on the side.
Yeah, so who are the types of people that would use these sorts of information sources? I mean, going back to the individual voting issue, like, voting can be hard. It can be hard as a shareholder to know what's even on the ballot or what's going on behind the scenes at the company or which way you should vote if you even do want to vote. And oftentimes, as a shareholder, you just have too many different companies that you're invested in. I mean, for example, like, I don't have that much money in the stock market, but I have a little bit through my retirement account, which is managed by, I think, Vanguard. But I don't even know what stocks I hold, let alone vote those shares myself. So there were a couple laws that are relevant to this. One in 1988, which was enforced by the Department of Labor, they declared that it was part of the fiduciary duty of managers of plan assets to actually vote the proxies of their investors. And then there was another rule in 2003, an SEC rule, that extended a similar sort of duty to mutual funds as well as other types of retirement plans. And so now the way that it works is if you have your money invested in a mutual fund or in some sort of retirement fund, you're not going to vote those shares yourselves. You're going to have the fund vote them for you. Now, the fund doesn't want to get in trouble for voting them the wrong way. And they also need to have information about how to vote. And so they typically refer to pieces of information, newsletters like the ones that Luigi mentioned earlier, and in general, proxy advisory services to make these sorts of decisions for them.
That's right. And these proxy advisory services have played an increasingly important role in helping shareholders cast their votes. And the marketplace is dominated by two large firms. ISS and Glass Lewis, or are sometimes estimated to have as much as 97% of the proxy advice market. One of the things that's been challenging for me is to watch the debate in Washington unfold about these advisors, because there is really no target of corporate and executive disdain as intense as the proxy advisory firms. It is impossible to escape a cocktail party in Washington or New York without having somebody angrily talk about the role of Glass Lewis and ISS. And I guess my reaction is to think that the more information investors have about how to cast their votes, the better, especially, Kate, because we live in the world you described, a world where the ordinary investor is diversified, has few incentives to invest in corporate governance or oversight or to pay attention to corporate management. And therefore, the more advice we can give otherwise rationally apathetic shareholders to participate in corporate governance, the better.
Can you tell us how the new rules that the SEC has proposed, and by the way, there are 60 days to object to those rules, so people are in time to submit some objections, how those rules are going to change the way in which the market for proxy advisory work?
Well, Luigi, you're right. So there are 60 days to comment, and I urge all the listeners and the both of you to come forward with new data on this.
Wait, sorry, can I interrupt really quickly? So if people comment really negatively, does that mean that the rules won't pass?
Not necessarily, okay. But we are required by law to read and review and think through every comment.
Okay.
And I can promise you, even when I disagree with my colleagues, we try very hard to engage with the evidence we get from the marketplace. Luigi's question was, how will this affect ISS and Glass Lewis? And the answer is clear. What the SEC rule does is impose a tax on anti-management advice. If the ISS or Glass Lewis want to recommend in favor of management, nothing changes. Under the new rules, more or less, they can proceed the same fashion. But if they want to recommend against the CEO, if they want to take a recommendation that management does not agree with, then they must do the following. They must check with management before they provide this advice to investors. They then must take feedback from management. And by the way, if management don't like the proposal, trust me, they'll have feedback. Then they have to send the advice to their clients, but have to include, in many cases, a link to management's view in their final advice. And by the way, they must do all of this with the threat of federal securities liability if the management doesn't like their methodology, their approach, the data that they used, etc. And we all know that the threat of serious federal litigation obviously tilts the scales in the kind of decisions folks make. So the answer is, what the SEC's proposal will do if it's adopted is simply move advice toward management, because it will tax anti-management advice from proxy advisors.
I'm not a lawyer, but this seems to me sort of like if you had a regular court case and you have like a plaintiff and a defendant, and it's a new rule is passed, the plaintiffs have to submit everything they know and everything they're going to argue to the court, and the defendants get a chance to see all of that, but that the defendants don't have to do the same sorts of actions. Do you think that that's a fair analogy?
Yeah, I think it is. Or another way to think about it is, suppose we were looking at Kate, do you use the website Yelp?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so I like Yelp. It gives you like very interesting feedback on the places where you can eat. It's a little bit like the customer having to check with the restaurant before posting a review to Yelp. Now look, we can debate whether or not that would lead to more or less accuracy, but for sure it would lead to reviews that are more favorable to the restaurant's management. Whether that'd be good or bad for consumers is a separate question. Here's what I would say, Kate. I hope the Department of Health and Human Services does not adopt such a rule, because I don't think it's the role of those who would protect ordinary consumers to tip the scales in favor of management.
And so there's also this other proposed rule change that has to do with the resubmission of shareholder resolutions. Can you explain that? And can you explain what the rule's really about?
Sure. So our second package of rules in this area would take the required vote on a shareholder proposal and increase it if you want to resubmit it in the next year. So for example, suppose you would submit a resolution this year and it gains only 4% support. Question is, could you resubmit it next year? The answer, as until this rule was adopted, was yes, you could. Going forward, the answer would be no, you could not. Now, a question you might have about this is, look, Rob, if the proposal only gains 4% support, maybe it's a good idea to get it off the ballot, because it's obviously not one that investors like. But this makes an assumption. It's a little bit like a workshop paper that has a weakness. It makes an assumption that we should spell out. The assumption is that the short-run voting results reflect the value of the shareholder proposal. And I don't know if you noticed, but when Luigi spoke earlier, he pointed out that even proposals that don't get majority support still can draw very substantial amounts of shareholder support and still be ones that are value enhancing. Rather than just look at the vote total, I think we should look at the long-run value implications of proposals. And the answer is that the amount of vote result that you get in the first or second vote is not necessarily indicative of whether they're good proposals. And that's why I dissented from those rules.
But let me play for a second the devil's advocate here, because of course there is a risk of blocking some reproposal. There's also a cost of having a lot of gadfly proposals repeated year after year without much of a following and without much of an effect. And my fear is that too many of those gadfly proposals actually make it difficult to create a space for a serious discussion on the other ones. And my understanding of the new rule is not that it prohibits the representation. It just delays by a few years. And so if this is a long-term benefit, the long-term benefit might manifest in the long term. So even if I cannot propose it next year, in 2 or 3 years, I can repropose it. So it's a bit like with a referendum for Scotland independence. You propose it, but you don't want a referendum every year. If the referendum does not win, you want at least not repropose it for the next X number of years.
So Luigi, I guess my question to you is, how long should investors have to wait to increase value? Because for me, to the degree we think it's a value-enhancing proposal, we don't want to knock it off the ballot. And by the way, these new rules knock it off the ballot for 3 years. That's a substantial amount of time to ask investors to wait. And by the way, Luigi, let me just be clear. My colleague's proposal, in my statement I said, this is like swatting a gadfly with a sledgehammer. This would not just exclude the gadfly proposals you're worried about. No. Also, we showed we presented new data in our statement that 40% of proxy access proposals that allow investors to put their own candidate on the corporate ballot, those would be thrown off by this new rule. 50% of shareholder proposals that would require CEOs to keep skin in the game, those would be bounced off the ballot. So I agree with you, Luigi, that we have to manage and balance the cost and benefits here. But I would propose a rule that would address just the Zingales gadfly problem, rather than take valuable corporate governance innovations off the corporate ballot.
So what would be your rule if you were the chairman of the SEC?
I would develop a rule specifically targeted at this problem. So for example, Luigi, there have been many proposals in this area that would say that a particular kind of shareholder should be limited in the amount of times they can access the ballot in a particular year. Or if you prefer, I actually like a private ordering solution. You could give to issuers, to companies, a basis to exclude a proposal on a gadfly exclusion and say, look, we believe that this proposal is not of the serious type that Luigi Zingales has described on the podcast. Instead, it is a gadfly proposal. Therefore, we wish to exclude it from our ballot. And the SEC staff could weigh in on the appropriateness of that, like we do for every other kind of exclusion for shareholder proposals. So I think there are lots of very tailored ways to deal with this problem. Unfortunately, my colleagues went so much further is to get very basic corporate governance innovations like proxy access off the ballot at many companies.
One thing I don't understand is why there wasn't more of a decision to use the size of the support for the proposal as a criterion. Currently, if I understand, you have to have $2,000 worth of stock and have held it just for a year. So it's very low as a threshold. The threshold is going up. Either you have 2,000 for 3 years, or you have 25,000 for a year, or something like that. If I require a larger threshold, as long as I can allow people to coordinate and sign on this, and I keep actually the holding period shorter, because the holding period is a way to make it more difficult for institutional investors to get involved. Why isn't this a way to penalize the gadflies, but let proposal that have a significant amount of following to be on the ballot?
Oh, I think it would, Luigi. This is these are good ideas. One thing to be clear about from the proposal that was made last week is that it prohibits aggregation of individual stakes so as to cross the particular thresholds. So it rules out the
possibility. Let me stop it. It prohibits the allegation, the aggregation of different stakes?
Absolutely.
Why?
If I had the answer to that question, my friend, I'd be in the majority, not the dissent. Look, for me, this is what I mean by swatting a gadfly with a sledgehammer. these are not tailored solutions to the particular economic problems that we're facing, a balancing of costs and benefits. This is just full stop making it harder for shareholders to bring proposals and making it easier for CEOs to navigate the annual meeting. By the way, here's what's so frustrating to me. Luigi, okay, I know you know, there's lots of very good scholarship making pro-management arguments for why we should make it harder for investors to intervene. I'd love to have that debate with my colleagues. We can have that debate on the podcast right now. But we should come forward and say what we are doing. What we're saying is we prefer to trust corporate managers and grapple with the agency costs than allow investors to have a say. If that's the choice we want to make as a society, we can make it, but we should call it what it is.
Yeah, but this looks like the old restriction against gathering that the monarchs in Europe used to have in order to prevent democracy to spread.
Well, without commenting too much on that, here's what I'll say. I think it's very frustrating for shareholders who have been participating in this process for a long time, because it doesn't feel like a problem, like a solution for a particular problem. It just feels like tipping the scales toward management. Look, these are areas with very strong intuitions. People have very strong views. And what I try to do is say, look, the fact is we'll be taking 40% of proxy access off the ballot. We'll be taking 50% of share retention proposals off the ballot. And whatever you think, maybe you think that's a good thing. We can have that debate, of course. But let's just agree that that is what we are doing. We are not solving the gadfly problem. We are going much further than that.
If you like listening to Capital Isn't, there's a good chance you're interested in pioneering research and groundbreaking discoveries. Big Brains, another podcast from the University of Chicago, brings the work and ideas of the world's smartest thinkers straight to your earbuds, with guests like David Axelrod.
If you know people, if you understand something about them, it's harder to dehumanize them, it's harder to hate them, even if you disagree with them.
Richard Thaler.
Those two words, systematic bias, that was the big aha moment. If there are systematic biases, then you can make better predictions.
And Ewing.
We now, in the past couple of decades, have started thinking about schools not as things that we have rights to, but rather something that we are to consume and choose.
You'll hear the stories behind the research reshaping our world. Listen and subscribe to Big Brains wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's talk a little bit about market power, right? Going back to some stats thrown around earlier, it seems like ISS and Glass Lewis, the two, basically the only two proxy advisory firms that operate in this market, they are an oligopoly. Maybe ISS is even a monopoly or bordering on that. Is this something that we should be worried about? Do we think that this actually affects the prices that they're charging for the information that they provide? And is there anything that can be done to promote competition in this market?
So yes, we should be concerned about it. And I gave a speech about a year ago where I urged my colleagues at the SEC to take a look back at our statute that powers us to make rules. That statute requires we consider the effects on competition of any regulatory step we take. When we make rules in the proxy advisory space, we risk turning a two-firm market into a one-firm market. And part of my argument to my colleagues on the commission and in the corporate community has been, if you don't like a world where you're held accountable by two proxy firms, imagine a world where you're held accountable by a monopolist proxy firm that has the sole power to tell American investors how to vote their shares. And the truth is, you know, I know you know both know the history here very well. It's been decades and there hasn't been a tremendous amount of competition in the space. And the reason is very straightforward. It's just not that profitable a business. We have seen entrants. People have attempted to enter over the years. Companies have opened and closed shop because they couldn't make the economics of the business work. It is a very low margin, not highly profitable business. And that's why there aren't more entrants. And that's what worries me about adopting new regulations. Because if we impose those costs, the incumbents will be able to pay them because they've achieved the scale necessary to do it. But it'll make entrants very, 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 very difficult to enter and compete. And that's why I think the rules that we proposed have made it much less likely that we're going to have a competitive market in the future, and much more likely we're going to have a monopoly, because it'll be very, very difficult for both firms to survive with all these regulatory changes.
But whether they have absolute power or have some power, I think a source of concern, number one, is the fact that it is a duopoly. And it's actually funny, I read the American Chamber of Commerce position paper on the topic, And they are extremely concerned about concentration, and they make arguments that are in favor of regulating monopolies or oligopolies, which they're not very willing to apply in other areas. But in this area, they seem to be very in favor. The second is, what is the potential effect of conflict of interest? So we know that ISS, that actually in the cocktail party, they call it ISIS, the ISS, what they do, they also sell their services. So at the same time, they judge and decide how to vote. On the other hand, they advise you how to behave. And surprise, surprise, if you behave well and you pay well, also they tell you to vote in favor. And while Glass-Lewis is more rigorous on that, they don't have a business on the side. They are owned by the Ontario Teacher Pension Fund. So at least in principle, it could be that they represent some specific interest. Maybe this ownership has an impact on the way they operate. Now, in a world of competition where we had many of these players, this will not be such a major issue. But when we come down to two, that is a concern.
I think that's absolutely right. It's a conflicted business, and it should be subject to rigorous disclosure. ISS already does some disclosure. But look, you guys know that I'm a scholar who's concerned about CEO compensation and conflicts of interest. I can't be of the position that CEO conflict should be disclosed, but ISS conflict should not. No. The consulting model there is highly conflicted, leads to all kinds of questions about what ISS is being paid for and why. And I think rigorous disclosure of that is absolutely necessary. And to the degree the rules advance that objective, I'd be happy to support them. Again, what's frustrating is they go so much further than this, requiring not only disclosure of the conflicts, but also asking ISS to run their opinions by management before they can tell their clients what they should do.
No, that part I agree 100%. That seems to me crazy. But why not propose a structural remedy, which is break up and give away the consulting business? After all, this was also imposed by Summit Oxley for the auditors. They were in a similar situation, and they were playing on both sides, and Sarbanes-Oxley put some limit on that.
So to the degree that we end up with a legal mandate from Congress, like Sarbanes-Oxley, that allows us to attack this problem, and by the way, Luigi, not just you could do more than you could not just break them up, you could have an office that oversees this area. I would be in favor of all of these kinds of things.
What about a sort of nudge on the part of institutional investors? So rather than like setting up a new office, maybe set up a kind of like opt-in system where if you have your money in a mutual fund or if you have your money in a retirement fund, you have to select a proxy advisory service. So this not only makes people aware of the proxy advisory services that exist, but it gives them, like, it puts the power in the hands of the actual ultimate shareholders. As it is now, like Vanguard, Fidelity, I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming that they use ISS, but I don't actually know the answer to that question. So I think if people felt more empowered, then this might actually, you know, promote healthier competition in this market. And it might also promote competition along the lines of specialized advisory services. Like you might have some that just focus on issues of the environment or just some that just focus on issues of like social civil rights. And also this seems to me like more of a market solution.
So there's a lot that's appealing about that solution, but a lot that's complicated about it. Let me say a little bit about that. So first, Vanguard, Fidelity, BlackRock, those large firms, they do use proxy advisory services, but they've also built their own in-house governance teams that oversee and that actually cast the votes. And in the case of Vanguard, there have been recent developments in sending that authority more toward the portfolio managers and giving them more oversight over the way votes are cast. But the truth is, Kate, they use those services. And if you're at Vanguard, you pay for some of those services. I don't disagree that you should know more about the way that they're used. What would worry me about an opt-in or opt-out system is that as it is, it's hard to get individual investors to engage in the process of corporate governance. I mean, Kate, as we said earlier, you're not even sure which firms you own, which companies you're in. So asking you to weigh in about the optimal source of advice when it comes to voting your shares, that's a lot to ask of an ordinary investor. But that doesn't mean I'd be against asking it. I'd want to structure the rule to make sure we draw the right inference from investor decisions.
I think that that's fair, but I will just say that I think it requires a lot less information to select a certain category of advisor than it does to actually know what stocks are in your portfolio.
Well, that's very fair. And Kate, let me point to something else. I gave a testimony to the Federal Trade Commission last year where I pointed this out. I don't think ordinary investors know, in general, how the institutions they invest with tend to vote their shares. Kate, let me ask you. Vanguard, that's where you keep your retirement savings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are they pro-management, anti-management, or down the middle? What's your sense?
My sense is that they're probably pro-management.
Right. So one thing I would like is for the SEC to play a better role in giving you a quick answer to that question. You could also do polling of ordinary retail investors, just to try and get a sense for what their actual preferences are for voting on these things. One of the things that's so hard for me about the debate we're having right now is we're not talking at the SEC about making sure that the way votes are cast actually reflect the preferences of the underlying ultimate investors. And the reason I'm for that is because I'm a big believer in and concerned about agency problems. I think we'd be better off asking the people whose money is at stake what they want out of corporate elections. So for that reason, I think you're right that Kate has a good idea. Anything that gets at what ordinary investors really want in the voting process is something I'm for.
But so what is the principle that they try to follow at the SEC? If this is not to try to capture what shareholders want, what is the overarching principle?
So I have to tell you, one of the criticisms I shared in my statement last week is I don't know what principle is guiding the proposal that we made. Would be they generally feel that the last 20 or 30 years have involved a shift from management to shareholders in terms of power, and that somehow the role of the SEC is to reverse that trend. I don't know why we would be in the business of dictating that outcome, even if I granted the premise, and Luigi, I don't, because the three of us know very well that actually the last 30 years have been pretty good years in terms of managerial power in the United States. The approval of the poison pill, the widespread use of staggered boards. There are many impediments to the exercise of shareholder authority, to say nothing of the standard collective action problems that investors have suffered for decades. So I don't know why we'd be in the business of resetting that balance.
But sorry, with what underlying idea they claim they want to do that? Because I thought that many members of this administration were kind of a free market. They didn't want to interfere on the natural outcome of the market. And here you're saying they want to interfere, but they want to interfere on the side of management against shareholders.
So I think that's a reasonable read of what happened last week. And here's what I'd say. You know, free market philosophy, I don't think last week's proposal represents a free market thinking.
I don't understand why this is so confusing. The Trump administration seems to be pro-business and anti-regulation, and it seems to be doing just that through this SEC vote. So sorry, maybe I'm being a little unfair to your colleagues, but I'm just...
Are you saying that Trump is pro-business but not pro-market?
Well, right. So I think, Kate, it's a very – I understand your reaction, and I'll leave it to you to make that point. But here's what I'd say. It's interesting. It's not pro-business. It's pro-management.
Right.
And I think it's so important to draw that distinction because, look, I have a MBA in finance from Wharton. I learned pro-business. I know what pro-investor actually means. The idea that we would favor corporate management is not pro-business. In fact, it risks extraction of very substantial agency costs. No, I would think this is a pro-management move and maybe justifiable as a policy choice. But again, that's not the debate that we had last week.
So let's address, I guess, the elephant in the room, which is, okay, so what if they had called it that? What if they had said, look, we want to support management at the expense of disenfranchising shareholders. We just think that that's the right decision to make at this point in time. Are there any potential benefits from doing that? I mean, maybe, you know, shareholders do have too much power. And I have to say that on recent episodes, that's been exactly the point that we've been discussing. And so it is, in some sense, a little hypocritical of Luigi and I to be saying, no, like, shareholders do need to be the ones with the power.
Well, I'm a big fan of the podcast. And so, for sure, I understand the reasons to be skeptical of too much shareholder power, but I never took your Luigi's argument to be the answer to this is to hand more power back to CEOs. No, instead, the consideration is giving more influence to other stakeholders, et cetera. But I think all of us who spent time in the corporate governance scholarship know that for 30 or 40 years, corporate management has been telling us, trust us, we'll deal with long-term problems like environmental issues, social issues, et cetera. And I don't think anybody across the marketplace right now is in a place where we think the solution to our problems, either as a society or as a market, is to hand more power to management.
Yeah, and our discussion of the Business Roundtable statement was exactly in that direction, is we don't think that we want more power to the CEOs. And the Business Roundtable statement was a huge power grab in that direction.
I have sort of a devil's advocate argument to make here, and this is also going against what I said on that earlier episode about stakeholders versus shareholders, but my impression of the way that managers acted in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s is that, yes, I mean, maybe they extracted perks, right? Maybe they, like, got themselves planes and, you know, ate fancy dinners on the shareholders' dime. But another source of alignment that they had was with their employees. I think that especially back in the day when they lived closer to their employees and were members of the communities in which their businesses operated, that there was some sort of social pressure to pay employees maybe higher wages than the market would dictate, or to invest in local charities. And so to the extent that you think that maybe labor is disenfranchised today because of like the secular demise of labor unions, and if we don't think that those rights are coming back, then maybe giving managers more power at the expense of shareholders is a backdoor way of giving employees more rights.
See, Kate, I feel like you tried so hard to make that argument well.
I did.
I mean, and bravo, but I got the sense that by the end you'd run out of gas. And here's why. The fundamental proposition is if you want to secure the future of the American worker, trust CEOs. And it's such a ludicrous idea that saying it out loud, it makes it hard to keep a straight face. I mean, I have no doubt that American CEOs understand the crisis we have in the American middle class, want to address it. And I believe that they're thoughtful, brilliant leaders who want to solve the problem. But the idea that we would solve the balance of power between the American middle class and others in the society by asking, trusting CEOs to make those decisions just doesn't make much sense. They're simply not well positioned to understand what the problems are and what mechanisms we might have to solve it. So that's why I like you, was skeptical about the Business Roundtable statement and why I'm skeptical that the solution to America's problems lies in the minds of American CEOs. I tell you right now, I would be happy. You can put me down in favor of I will happily give American CEOs power to exclude more shareholder proposals from the ballot if they promise me in exchange that they'll live in the same neighborhood as and attend the same church as their workers.
I mean, this is kind of why I was saying I was being the devil's advocate, because I believe that back then that was an important force in the minds of CEOs, is that they had to see their workers every day. They had to be members of their communities. And so it made sense that they sort of extracted perks or, you know, extracted rents away from shareholders and in favor of labor. But I don't think that that's the corporate environment in which we live today. And in order for them to be, you know, living in the same communities and going to the same churches, oftentimes that means they would have to move to, you know, like Myanmar or something. And so I don't see that. I agree, Rob. I don't see it being a very viable way of giving more power to labor.
So, Rob, we like to conclude the episode about whether the particular topic is an example of good capitalism or the capital isn't.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I think you'd have to look at our proposal from last week and say capital isn't. It's not a market-driven proposal. It's a proposal driven by the particular interests of CEOs in having an easier job. For that reason, I have to say the proposal comes down as capital isn't, but the great thing about this podcast is I hope many of your listeners will come forward and talk to the SEC about the rules we proposed. It's just a proposal, and try to persuade me and my colleagues to move in a direction that would be more capital is.
Rob Jackson, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. This was a great ending.
Ah, Luigi, this was so much fun. It's like a workshop, man. I should come here more often.
Yeah, you should.
In my job now, I never get to do this.
Really?
Yeah, no.
I would think that that's all you did at your job.
We need to talk.
You've been listening to Capital Isn't. hosted by Kate Waldock and Luigi Zingales, and produced by Matt Hodapp. Capital Isn't is a podcast of the University of Chicago Stiegler Center in collaboration with the Chicago Booth Review. You can find episode transcripts and research links at capitalism.com. Also, check out promarket.org, the blog of the Stiegler Center, and don't forget to subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts.